listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Chris Mueller is a national speaker, author, father of six, and is currently making a Catholic TV show for families as he travels speaking to over 10,000 people each year. Between Chris having over 18 years experience in Catholic lay ministry and Timmery's holding a master's degree in biblical theology, together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
You know, Timmery, this year marked the 15th year of marriage for myself and my bride.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. We looks like we made it 15 years. You know, it's interesting because when we got married, I thought I knew what I was getting into. And I didn't. I mean, it's funny how many people I talk to where I say, well, because we do confirmation, you know, at the high school. I do confirmation prep with the high school program. And I'll have parents say to me, like, well, I don't know that my student's ready to be confirmed. And I always say to them, well, did you know what you were getting into when you got married? And they all go, no. I'm like, well, this is a sacrament too. Like, they may not fully comprehend it, but as long as they want it, then that matters, right? And I think there's this idea now that you can't get married until you're absolutely ready to get married and you know what that's going to be. But if you talk to any person who's been married, they will all tell you, as ready as we were, we had no idea what we were getting into.
We had no idea what we were getting into. I think it's so fascinating to see the challenges. There's this picture of a friend of mine on her front mantelpiece. And when you walk in, it is just this picture of her radiating joy, walking down the aisle at the end of the wedding. And she's holding on to her new husband. And she's just so happy. She looks just like a kid who just came out with a bunch of candy at a candy shop. It was like three or four. She looks so excited. And she always points that and talks about how she just felt like, I got him. This is it. And, you know, she's there. But then there are so many struggles and joys and mountains to climb and valleys to make it through that were a part of marriage she never expected, but she loved the opportunity.
Oh, I absolutely love being married. My wife and I say this all the time, like, I'm so glad I'm not dating anymore. You know, like I love being married to my wife. And I love that everything that's come from that, our children in their lives and all the stuff that we're involved in. But to think that I somehow was going to have my life together and everything in order and have the perfect job and the perfect apartment and zero debt or whatever it is. And then we were going to get married and it was all going to be perfect and everything was going to be order. And according to the plan that I had in my head, it would be insane. Like it just doesn't. Like the minute you say I do, the plan is out the window.
Well, isn't that most of life? I mean, I think about it, maybe a lot of life and our plans and our lack of patience are preparing us for that vocation, right, of marriage. Or maybe you're choosing to enter into a vocation of priestly or religious life. And even that takes a lot of patience and time. I mean, think about the number of years that go through seminary, right? And
right.
This preparation to make those final vows. You know, in marriage, that gift of saying yes and working through those struggles together, that's day in and day out. What life is in general, just you have someone by your side here.
Right. Oh, absolutely. You know, it's funny. When we got married, I was so excited to be married to my wife. I mean, absolutely. And I still am. But I remember there was this period of time, and I don't want to be negative about it, but like, I feel like I joke around with my wife all the time and say, well, you definitely had some buyer's remorse right there in the beginning. Like, because there were things where she realized, like, oh my gosh, you really are a slob. Like you really, this is just who you are. And now I'm stuck with you, you know? And obviously you adjust. But what's been beautiful about marriage, I think, is I've gotten more organized. I've gotten to be more of a planner. I've gotten to think, you know, those things and be less impulsive, like with money and things like that. She's gotten a little bit more relaxed. She's gotten to be a little bit less of a planner. She's gotten to be a little bit, you know, and so I think we've both become healthier because of each other.
Well, and you know, it's funny. So I'm dating, I'm not married, but exactly what you just said could describe a challenge that we've been going through. You know, my boyfriend and I, of me being super planning, organizing everything, and him being maybe more relaxed, even with, you know, a lot of things more relaxed. And that attitude of how two people together challenge each other in that period of growth and finding a way to kind of dance around each other, but do it correctly still.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I think one of the most important things for you know, this idea of it's not what I expected, right? When I got married, it didn't work out the way I thought it would, or I had no idea what I was getting into. One of the best pieces of advice we got as we were preparing for marriage was my good friend, John Labriola. And he sat me down and he said, Chris, you're getting married. I said, yeah. He goes, it's 50-50, right? You do your 50. I said, yeah. He goes, no. If you do that, you're absolutely going to be divorced. It is never 50-50. You have to assume 100% all the time, and you have to throw the scoreboard out. And if you're not willing to serve and not worry about she's doing her 50%, it just won't work.
Well, it's that scorecard mentality. You know, there's a piece on Fox News. It was an opinion piece that came out where this woman is talking about her marriage and how excited she was to get married. And there's this adorable picture of them riding off on a snowmobile on the winter day and how she had no idea what she was getting into. And she talked specifically a lot about this scorekeeping and how we think, well, I did this, you did that. But what we're talking about then is a quid pro quo relationship where I scratch your back, you scratch my back. Okay, we're even. Maybe I owe you a little something. But the reality is that in general, think about your day. Sometimes we have days that are less productive.
Right.
Sometimes we have days that are more productive. Maybe we don't feel good on a particular day and we're doing the best we can, you know, and there are going to be days where people maybe put very little, maybe in effort or maybe in capability on that day.
Yeah, this piece is great. And she says this thing, I didn't realize that being a wife meant not complaining about the underwear on the bathroom floor or the dirty jeans left on the bed, because at the end of the day, those things don't matter. Mm-hmm. And it's such a different change of mindset. I remember there was a silly thing that when my wife and I were married maybe 5 years, that just bothered me. She would put things in the microwave and she would never let it run out. She'd always open it like 5 seconds before. So it was constantly had like 5 seconds left on it. And one day I was like, I just can't deal with it anymore. And it was such a stupid thing to be like irritated by, right? And I look at the mountain of things that she puts up with for me. And I'm absolutely the dirty, you know, I have a pile of laundry in the room that I keep by the side of the bed because it's my rewear pile. Like, it's not dirty enough yet in my mind to put in the dirty laundry. I might go back to that pile. Like jeans. Jeans are unlimited wears, right?
Your wife must have a lot of patience. That would drive me nuts.
Oh, I know. And I think it's hard. And it's just like things I don't even see, right? But she, like, that's not her world, right?
Okay, but that's a really good point, because I think there's a lot in life that we individually do not see that we are doing. And so now you've invited another person into your space and they're seeing these different things you do and it aggravates them, right? But you may not even be aware that, oh, there's a problem with the pile of laundry on the floor in the middle of the room still.
Well, and my rewear pile means there's less laundry to do, right? So I'm being, and I think
you're helping her.
Well, it's another really important thing that people don't realize in marriage is how quickly we assign motives. Mm-hmm. Right. And as a culture, someone cut you off on the freeway and you assign motive, like, well, how could they do that to me? And they didn't even know you were there. In marriage, your spouse has a rewear pile like me. And it's so tempting to assign motive, like, well, they don't care about the work I do, or they don't do this, or you come home early because it's date night. And then all of a sudden it just, my wife is exhausted because we have 6 kids and life is life and we're going a million directions. And then it's so tempting to want to assume, like, well, she doesn't care about me or blah, blah, blah. And like, that's the one thing I think people don't realize. When you get into marriage, you have to always assume the best of the other person, right? And you can't play that game of, I know what they're thinking. You don't know what they're thinking. You have to ask, like, hey, what's going on? How are you? The other side of that is, if someone asks how you're doing, you have to be able to tell them. That silent game thing will destroy your marriage just as quickly.
You know, and I think especially for people who maybe have a tendency to be more critical, learning to see the good in the other person and choosing to see the good rather than just looking at the fault or what they just did. See, okay, here are a million other things that they do well, right? And choosing to see those things in those most challenging circumstances. I love where you talk about the silence too, you know, overcoming that silence of making an intentional effort. We're talking about teenagers before we started the show and how they go through this phase, right? Where kind of things are meh, they don't really communicate, and it's annoying, right? And
right.
It's frustrating. Well, we too can do that at different periods in our life. And we have to find ways. I know I personally have a hard time with conversation, random conversation. So I'll think of, oh, I just read this really great book, and bring up the random book, whatever it might be.
Right. You know, John Eldridge is an evangelical guy. He wrote a book called Wild at Heart, and he's done a lot of men's ministry. And I had the opportunity to go on a retreat with him. And he brought up the, you know, when Jesus says, turn the other cheek. Right. Mm-hmm. And we tend to think of that as a very passive, non-masculine thing to do. But when you turn the other cheek, it means you're still there. You're still engaged. You didn't run away. And a lot of times in marriage, what happens is there's conflict, there's misunderstanding, there's something you know that's going to be an argument. And what a lot of men will do is they'll passively just not deal with it, right? Right? And so, because right. I don't, you know, they don't stand up to it. And so, like, you'll see your wife just
fuming, right? It's building, it's getting worse. And now, you know, it's like a rancorous, this resentment that starts to kick in.
And so, rather than going, I know you're mad. What are you mad about?
You know.
Right. Well, but we don't know. Is that
make, sometimes.
But like the, so you learn that I have to deal with that, right? And vice versa. My wife too. I can't say like, well, she's the only one who gets mad and fumed. I stomped around the house for like 3 weeks, you know, like a month or two ago about something, you know, just being stupid. And finally she's like, are you going to keep doing this? Like, you know, and then we had to argue a little bit. No one's belittling the other person, right? But we had to talk it out and it had to be uncomfortable. You know, you have to be ready to stand there and be present to each other, even in the uncomfortable times.
Well, and being willing to argue, I think especially guys get into this attitude of avoiding the argument at all costs. And we've got to find a way to talk about things. And I think on our side, especially as women, sometimes coming up and saying, okay, I'm actually really sad about this. Not getting overly emotional, right? But just saying, I'm really sad about this. Now move past the fact that you've expressed that you're sad. Now talk about how are we going to resolve this? Or what do I need to communicate to you that I'm experiencing to help make this move forward?
Right. I think the worst thing that the media does is they say, just admit you're wrong, guys, and move on. No, because sometimes you have to say like, no, I'm not wrong. I'm hurt. This happened, right? And so as a couple, you have to give each other permission to be right sometimes and permission to be wrong sometimes. It can't always be one person's fault.
Coming up on the show, we're going to be talking about this heroic nurse who refused to perform an abortion. We'll also be talking about a genetic study that came out, talking a little bit, maybe pointing toward the flood. I don't know. You'll hear more on Trending.
Chris and Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at CMueller.com. Tweets, spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R, and at Timmery, that's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
A really neat moment in the United States here is when people continue to stand up for religious liberty, to stand up for that gift that our country offers of being able to live your faith outside of the four walls of a church.
Yeah, and I think we forget how unique that concept is in human history. Like, this was not something that was part of the Western kind of reality. I mean, if you lived in England, you were part of the Church of England. And if you weren't, then you were practicing a faith that was not allowed. If you live in the Middle East, you're Muslim. And if not, then you're paying heavy fines and facing massive persecutions. The fact that our founders said, no, you need to have a freedom to choose the religion of your choice, that was revolutionary.
You know, I look at this and House Speaker Paul Ryan recently honored a true hero, Kathy DiCarlo, and she ended up experiencing back in about 2010, 2012, the beginning of a challenge where she was asked to participate in an abortion. And she right away had the opportunity. She hopped online, started calling her supervisors. They told her, you know, referred her to this person, that person. Eventually, she says, look, when I was hired on here 5 or 6 years ago, I was told I would never have to participate in an abortion. I let you guys know. And now I'm being called upon to do so. Her supervisors tell her she has to participate in the abortion, Chris. And she ends up responding by trying to call in other nurses because she had about a 6-hour time frame where it wasn't happening right away. Well, they ended up coercing her, basically saying that it was a life or death situation. And they ended up calling on her not to just participate in actually performing the abortion, but reassembling the parts of the baby because it was a life or death situation, and manipulated her into participating. And she then ended up that night contacting a legal firm and working with them to stand up for her religious liberty in this case.
The graphic nature of abortion is so, so disturbing. But I don't know that people realize that when, particularly late-term abortion, any abortion, when they dismember that little human being in its mother's womb, they then have to reassemble and count the parts. The baby is not delivered whole. It is chopped up inside of its mother, then removed. And they then have to count the pieces to make sure that they didn't leave anything in because that can cause infection and all those things.
The severe infection. I think that that's where, in some cases, they don't reassemble the baby. And so there's risk of health, really, really major health consequences for these women. I've seen some of the worst circumstances where this has taken place. But really, the person who has to reassemble those baby body parts, imagine what that must be like in justifying this. And now in this case, I mean, thank God Kathy didn't have to participate in the actual performing of the abortion, but she was manipulated into reassembling the pieces of this baby. And could you imagine, you guys? And this is also a later term abortion that took place here as well.
Right. So you're dealing with an infant. Mm-hmm. I mean, at any point you're dealing with a human being, but this is a late term abortion. This is a baby that is recognizably a ready to be born, viable baby.
You know, I look at this and I thank God for people who are willing within the medical field to say no to performing abortions, to say no in medical school to performing abortion for the purpose of learning, right? Like, this is something that is absolutely 100% unacceptable. It is harmful for the woman. It is not good for her mentally, emotionally, psychologically, physically. And it destroys, first and foremost, the life of a human person.
Yeah, I think we, you know, there this concept of, well, you have a right to believe whatever, the right to believe in your faith. But if you don't have a right to practice it, then you don't have that right. And again, I don't know if this is a private hospital, public hospital, or whatever, but this is clearly a situation of persecution of this woman. There was no reason that they had to have this one nurse who was opposed to abortion go in there and do this, other than that they were saying, we can make you do this. We basically own you.
Well, and they threatened her with a disciplinary action when she first refused to even participate in the actual procedure of the abortion. And the fact that they did this is just atrocious, that any person would force another individual to participate in abortion. I think at the end of the day, we know what abortion is. And so that is true malice. It's just evil at that point. And so I thank God that she really stepped up. She contacted a law firm. They ended up working to initiate with the hospital the fact that there's a constitutional right to religious liberty. And you guys have violated that. So it took about a year and a half to 2 years, but the hospital ended up coming out back in 2012 saying, we've renegotiated our policies and no one will be forced to perform an abortion because it's a constitutional right to religious liberty.
This is not a good comparison, but imagine a Muslim person who objects to handling pork, right? You know, and you know, halal, they can't eat it, but objects to handling it for religious reasons, is then working in the operating room and is forced to then handle like a porcine heart valve that's going in. There could be any, and they object to it. They strongly, so, but no, your religious beliefs have no validity here. You're going to do it. This is life and death situation. This man needs this thing, but they strongly object to handling it. Do you not think that that would be major news on every single outlet, that this Muslim person had been forced to handle, you know, pork against their religious beliefs?
Well, I even talk, my dad working within the government makeup, you know, people are allowed to have their prayer mats, right, to come out and pray in the middle of the day, yet there's objection often to having crucifixes, crosses within the workplace. And so we've gotten to a point where there's tolerance for some people, but not tolerance for others. And the fact that there is not tolerance for someone who's saying, I will not participate in killing this small, tiny child who's supposed to be in the safest place in her mother's womb. Not to count the fact that, Chris, you know, you look at it, this was a late-term abortion. It wasn't early. No matter what point, it doesn't matter. It's not okay. But if you look at it, I am just disgusted to know that the United States is one of seven countries that allows abortion after 20 weeks. We're up there with North Korea and China.
You know, and sometimes you run into this idea that, well, you know, the pro-life is kind of this fringy thing, you know, these anti-abortion people or anti-rights, what they call us. The reality is it's not fringy. You know, over 50% of our country thinks this is wrong. And particularly when you talk about late-term abortion, like, it's horrific and is considered horrific by the majority of people in America. This isn't fringy. This isn't some like religious fundamentalist view. This is mainstream America. And we need to take that conversation back, because you look at the media, you look at the way it's portrayed, you know, on the news feed on your Facebook or your social media stuff, or, and it sounds like, oh, well, you know, these these people, no, they're you, they're me, they're your neighbors, the people in your town. The majority of the people you see on any given day would say, no, it's horrific to dismember a child, particularly in a late-term abortion, in its mother's womb. I mean, that is a horrific, inexcusable thing. And to think that people are doing that just out of convenience. I mean, this is, again, and they said it was for the life of the mother. That is such a rare, I mean, honestly, I've read things basically saying there is no situation where a late-term abortion is required to save the life of a mother.
Well, in either way, when you look at the numbers, it is less than 1% of all abortions here in the United States that take place either because of the life of the mother or due to rape or incest. Less than 1%. If you're looking at the number of abortions taking place or somewhere between the high 2000s and mid 3000 range, you're looking at a very small percentage of those abortions that are taking place for, again, health reasons or rape or incest. And so you look at this and it just breaks my heart that we are justifying forcing nurses against their good conscience to perform these abortions. And so thank God for people like Kathy DiCarlo. And I'm so glad that Paul Ryan honored her this past week, because it's a reminder that while we are one of the nations that has one of the most lenient abortion policies, right? Abortion up to that very last day of a woman's pregnancy. You can find that anywhere in the United States if you really demand it. Because of Casey versus Planned Parenthood, there can be no undue burden on a woman to receive abortion. So that was a Supreme Court decision back in 1992. Because certain states, it's fantastic. We pass these laws like the heartbeat law, where we pass these laws about requiring a sonogram. And so that saves more lives. But if a woman really objects, saying there's an undue burden on me to access this abortion, there are exceptions that still have to take place. And so it's a reminder that when you speak up, though, this hospital will not force other people to perform abortions now. So one person speaking up has changed a whole makeup for that hospital.
Right. And I think that's a lesson that we in the pro-life community really need to hear. Like, we need to speak up. And that's in your workplace. That's in what you watch and you consume. You know, I it's one of my pet peeves when I see kind of the bumper sticker social activism. Like, it's great to have a bumper sticker. It's great to wear a t-shirt. But if you're not willing to have a conversation with your neighbor, it's really not that useful.
Right. Well, and not just your neighbor, but I've had circumstances when I've been in the bathroom of Chipotle or at an event and you hear a couple of teenagers talking and there's this fear of pregnancy. They're not even talking about abortion yet, you guys, but there's a fear of pregnancy. They're taking that pregnancy test. You have a responsibility, not just an opportunity, to speak up and say, hey, if you need any help, just need someone to talk to, I know about a crisis pregnancy center in the area, give them a crisis pregnancy center hotline number, right? You know, talk to them about where the local crisis pregnancy center is, or say, you know, I know this is going to be really tough to tell your parents. I just want you to know that your parents love you so much. And if you need someone to help you tell your parents, take a friend, take someone who supports you, because the hardest thing in a crisis pregnancy is for that teenager to tell their parent.
And I think this is, you struck on something that is uncomfortable for us, but if we really want to change this, we have to talk to our kids about sex. And it's funny, the other side says this all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, Planned Parenthood is ready and willing and actively seeking to talk to your kids about sex. But if you, as a Catholic parent, are not doing that, then you're sending your kids out onto the battlefield, as Catechism 409 tells us, completely unarmed. Like, we need to emphasize the point that sex makes babies. And babies are a good thing, but we want to wait till then that proper context of a family, right? And if you're not ready to have a family, then you're not ready to be having sex. Like, and so all of these different methods to avoid pregnancy, none of them are 100%. So if you want to roll the dice that way, you're playing not only with your life, but the life of your child.
Much more to come on Trending. We want to remind you of the opportunity to speak up, have these difficult conversations. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a genetic study that shares information about animals.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
So, Chris, there was this massive genetic study that came out. It was published just over the last couple months, and it looks at how 9 out of the 10 species that we have today actually appeared at the same time, and that includes humans.
Right, so 9 out of 10 species appeared at the same moment, like 100,000 years ago, right? Like, just
Like, boom, at the same time, within a time frame between 100,000 and 200,000 years is when they are placing that.
That's interesting. How'd they figure that out? I always wonder when you hear studies like that, the universe is this old or this many people showed up at this time. How do they have any idea?
Okay, hold on a second. This was my soapbox that I was going to go off on. I am not a scientist. I do not get how they are able to label X so many years ago. This tree is X so old because of all the rings. I just don't get it either. We'll leave that to the scientific experts here.
Yeah, apparently, and I'm reading an article, so I'm going to pretend to be smart. It has something to do with mitochondrial DNA, and apparently there's two ways to look at DNA. There's like the DNA from your parents, and then you can get into like the mitochondrial DNA, which also, like, I guess you can get, you know, genetic barcodes from.
Right. So the first one is nuclear DNA. And so that's a part of our, that we have as individuals, right?
I so badly want to believe that that means I could have superpowers, because if we've learned anything from comic books, it's that nuclear radiation really can work in your favor sometimes, right? I mean, it can go well.
Well, so that nuclear DNA is specific to you. You receive it from your parents, like Chris said. It has unique makeup about you as an individual. But this mitochondrial DNA is a little bit more detailed in the sense that there are 37 different genes. And one of those is a COI gene, which can give information in a barcode, which some of these scientists and researchers have been able to determine there are commonalities that we can differentiate between the species, coming out to 10 here. And with that, we can also differentiate and see how old they are. And within that, they've placed that 9 out of the 10 of them have come into being at the same time. So what's interesting is they point to a catastrophic event that had to have somehow wiped out the majority of life as we know it.
It's interesting because I don't really know fully what the implications of this are. I read the article, and but what does this say about, you know, for instance, evolution? Right. Where we think
exactly.
that everything came from. And again, the church does not condemn evolution. You know, it basically says we have to believe that there's a plan, that there's a creator, that God set it in motion. And so I'm not saying you have to be a creationist. Right. But what does this say about the way that evolution is being thought of, taught and theorized?
But hold on a second. We have to be really clear in what the church has said about evolution. The church
right.
has defined two different types of evolution. One is microevolution and one is macroevolution. So macroevolution would not just be. So we'll go to micro first. Microevolution would be the changes of, say, a beak to accommodate more specifically, let's say, the picking up of food, right? Or the changing of the weather in a specific area that it's consistently changed. These are small little variations within a species. Macroevolution is the change between species. And the Catholic Church has been very clear. Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, they've been very clear, especially Pope Benedict, where he talked about how the church, you cannot in good faith believe in macroevolution. That's a changing between species, and it disrespects the dignity of the human person and life as God has made it.
Right, like monkeys becoming people.
Exactly.
Right. But changes within humanity, like, you know, so I have different people, like microevolution, as you're talking about, like, whereas some people in some regions may be smaller, some people in some
exactly.
regions may be taller.
Bigger
you know?
Heads, you know, all these different things that come to being, right, with the
yeah.
way we live, you know, we aren't as strong bone necessarily as the people before us. Like, they were hunters and gatherers in a way that we have a more sedentary, comfortable lifestyle today.
Right. And so you see most of, you know, the animals and creatures you can encounter coming into being 100,000 years ago. Well, what does that do to that theory of, you know, all dogs sprung from this one line of animals that we also came from as well? You know, what
exactly.
does it do to that?
So that's what it's saying. It's basically saying this has totally put a kibosh on all of the idea of evolution that they try to push so hardly. You know, there's small changes within a species, but there's no change from species to species. The species has relatively stayed the same. So between the fact that it just really hit on a lot of the claims of evolution, but also pointing to something like a catastrophic event like the flood. And so when you look at this, what we see is even the main geneticist, David Thaler, has been saying, he goes, this conclusion is very surprising, and I fought against it as hard as I could. Why? Because it points to a Christian biblical worldview that we have.
Well, and I think this is important, too, when we consider science. There's this move right now to say, oh, the science on that is settled. Right. And you hear it all the time, whether and I'm not going to get into the field of, because a lot of this stuff becomes, you know, matters of faith to some people, but like, no, we can't talk about that. The science on that is settled. And whether that's global warming or transgenderism or, you know, same-sex attraction or whatever it is. Oh, no, the science is settled. Chris, you need to know that. Well, no, you know, it's not settled. We are learning about our world all the time. And it's interesting, as we dive deeper into understanding this creation, what we see often, all the time, is the creator. Mm-hmm. The creator being revealed. And so when you hear people say that, think, no, the science is settled. You need to stop and go, yeah, but they thought the science was settled 100 years ago, too, and it wasn't.
And also, was it a theory that they're saying is settled, right?
Well, yeah, but theory in the language of science has different weight than when I say, like, well, I've got a theory about that, right? Like, right. It's a different thing.
But, I mean, we've been missing the proof of evolution, yet they've been teaching evolution for years. And that's what's also interesting about this, is there was one of the articles I was reading, it was talking about how years ago, there was a change in how we talk about science. And one of the things that happened is they started to manipulate the education within the school system of how we talk about how we came into being. And I know there's debate over Big Bang theory, creationists, evolutionists, and so forth. But the reality is that they started to incorporate literature that would make jokes, essentially, kind of knocking on a Christian worldview by talking about extraterrestrial creatures and how, you know, we were created and how we needed those extraterrestrial creatures in order to be created. Well, that's a knock in many ways on the dignity of the human person. And that's why we're talking about this.
Right. It's just very interesting. And if you're going to come at this from a perspective of science, the worst thing that you can say as a scientist is, well, that question's been answered. Because what we've found time and time again is every time we've answered a question, we've realized there's more to understand about that question. The church has a great term for this. We call it mystery. Right? Because every time you come into understanding of something about God, you realize there's more to understand about God. Mm-hmm. Well, our scientists need to embrace this idea of mystery as they study the creation, because the reality is nothing is ever settled. There's always more to learn. There's always the next door to walk through. And the reality is, as we walk through these things, even to the ends of the universe, what we find is there's something beyond that we mm-hmm. can't comprehend. And what is that great beyond we can't comprehend? Well, you and I, as people of faith, would say, it's God, right? And you may walk beyond and understand a little bit more about him, but what you're going to find is there's a little bit more you don't understand. Mm-hmm. So it's never settled. Why? Well, because mystery.
Right. And you look at the blueprint of God, these amazing different designs that he creates, right? The difference in the facial features of the human person, the difference in the animals and how they provide for each other, you know, the difference varying in the seeds of a piece of fruit. Like, you look at this and there had to be some sort of creator there. There had to be something present who had this intelligent design, right? This is the argument. If you look at the five proofs of God from intelligent design, there's some order to this. Even just looking at the food chain, right, of the different animals in the animal kingdom.
You know, what's interesting about this study, too, is I'm looking online right now to find out more about it, and I can't find other articles other than just the reposting of this article. So why is it being ignored?
So what's happening is, if you look at a lot of the research, for those just joining us, that's Chris Mueller. I'm Timmery Millington. You're listening to Trending. We're talking about a study, a massive genetic study that came out with surprising conclusions. It was done by Rockefeller University of New York, Mark Stockel from there, and then David Thaler from the University of Basel. And what they came to conclude is that basically 9 out of the 10 animal species appeared at about the same time. And one of the geneticists said, David Thaler, this conclusion is very surprising, and I fought against it as hard as I could. This fighting against it is this fighting against two things. One, this idea of evolution that has been so unproven in many ways, as they're trying to push macroevolution, a change between species, and this, and essentially knocking on the dignity of the human person. And at the same time, it's also pointing to the fact that there was a catastrophic event that wiped out most of life as we know it. On a large scale, it was some form of environmental trauma.
Yeah, exactly. And so what would that be? You know, the Bible gives various evidences. And of course, the Bible is not the only book of ancient literature that talks about this, of a massive flood.
Exactly.
Right? And that story is so common in Middle East, you know, mythology. So you wonder, maybe it happened. right? You know, and we see evidences of this. We've seen evidences of this before. So was that the cataclysmic event that led to the emergence of these species?
And that's what's so incredible, because it's not just this genetic study that's pointing to this. There have been a number of studies, whether it's studying the impact on the environment, right? And on the rocks, and how there were marks clearly of some sort of massive flooding that different parts of the world underwent. And you look at it, like you mentioned, Chris, if you look at different literature, you could go into Babylonian literature, all of these different ancient cultures, they have something like the flood that they end up referring to. And so it makes you say, you know, we can't discredit the Bible, yet people try so quickly to discredit this, some of the historical elements that we actually do know verified, right, that are in there.
You know, it's interesting. I'm digging around the internet to find more on this. I found evolutionnews.org, which is exactly what you think evolutionnews.org is. And what they're saying is this could indicate intelligent design, an event where species came into existence for the first time, but it could also indicate something else, as such as population crash or crashes that affected almost all life, well, which could also be part of intelligent design. I mean, like, you know, it all kind of works together. But it is interesting that even these kind of evolution, you know, godless, you know, pages are saying, wow, this could indicate evolution. It's there. I mean, you have to acknowledge that this is not what we expected. And it definitely challenges the way we've been looking at this.
Right. And I think that too, looking, you know, maybe you've never looked at it, but those five proofs for the existence of God, do you know them? I think as good Catholics, as good Christians, we have a responsibility to be able to speak to the existence of God. So I think that that's kind of why I wanted to talk about this idea of pointing, well, was there something like the flood that caused for all of these species to be wiped out in some way with some catastrophic event?
Chris and Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at C. Mueller Tweets, spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R, and at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about one man's testimony, talking about how marrying young really makes you marriage material, helps you to develop into a better version of yourself. You know, you work better in the professional world. But before we talk about that, Chris, I want to talk a little bit about this article that came out talking about a mother's plea for her baby's life. She was pregnant. Her name's Amanda in Ohio. And essentially, she was looking at delivering a baby early, a premature baby. And the hospital told her that unless she delivered right at that 22 weeks and 5 day period, there would be no assessment and no resuscitation of the child.
It is such a hard thing, that the premature birth, you know, and I have a nephew who was born right at the point of what they considered viability at the time, you know, and they fought for him, and he's, you know, in his 20s now, and he's doing fine. I have a little niece right now who was born very premature, and she's doing great. It's interesting. I'm reading the New York Times here about viability. And what they're saying is we're finding that babies as young as 22 weeks are viable, right? If treated. And so what happens in hospitals is they're now making the decision, do we treat or do we not treat? And it's an economic decision.
Right.
It's expensive. We talked about in the last segment that idea of mystery, right? That the science is never settled. That once we think we know something, we learn that we didn't know about it as much as we knew about it, right? And and we, as Catholics, we understand mystery. Well, here's a reality of human life, right? That we say, oh, no, 24 weeks is viability. Doctors have said this. Oh, no, and actually, they're actually discussing, should we move it to 24 weeks? Because it had been set earlier. Now we're finding, wait, oh my gosh, 22 weeks. Like, we're finding younger and younger children are viable. And so it's so frustrating when you have parents who want to fight for their child and hospital says, we won't, even though they know that children that young can be saved.
Well, and here's what they're doing. The baby is born. So for example, this woman, Amanda, held out as best she could, right, to have that baby until 22 weeks, 5 days, because that was when they would actually give the baby some bit of medical attention. She held out. She was able to wait. They ended up having the baby on that day prematurely, very much so prematurely. Emery Elliott is what they named the baby. And what happened, though, is what they did is they still refused to give the baby any medical treatment. And she was pleading and begging. She was holding her child. But you know what the hospital does? They then label the baby as a stillborn. They consider it a stillborn, But you guys, that baby was breathing. That baby was crying. That baby was interacting. There's even a video of this little baby that the family put up as they're asking for assistance, calling for help from medical professionals who are refusing. And I've got to throw this out here, Chris. This isn't the first time I've seen this. There was an organization I used to work for doing public relations work, and it's called Angels in Waiting. And Angels in Waiting basically came from nurses who were working within the emergency room field at the hospital. And they were seeing that women were coming in and giving birth to children prematurely. The baby was crying, the baby was interacting, but legally the nurses were told that they could not do anything. And they were told they had to leave the baby to die in a corner in a little dish, some type of medical dish. And so what happened is one of the essentially nurses said, "I can't do this anymore. I cannot do this anymore." And so she's been working for a number of years now to find ways to help save these premature babies, offering an option to help them live, to help them receive the proper medical treatment. So she works with nurses who have the skills to help give some of that medical treatment and put the babies in foster homes, because unfortunately, a lot of these babies being born prematurely in the hospitals are babies who are a product sometimes of different examples of substance abuse.
Right. And you can have, and there are complications that can come along with a child who's born very, very early too. You know, my nephew and his wife, they had issues with their baby and she was born very early, right? And mm-hmm. it was scary. The tragic thing was the doctors, essentially when they found out that they were having trouble holding the baby in the womb, basically said, "Well, we probably should abort." And it was just, why? Well, there could be complications. Well, guess what? There haven't been. She's perfectly healthy. She's doing great. I mean, she's a precocious little wonderful, you know, toddler. We don't give life a chance, mm-hmm. right? And again, why are they making that decision? Well, economics, right? It's they're looking at the, you know, what's the economic cost of saving this child, of fighting for the child, right? And the reality is this baby who's dying there in the hospital without assistance, they may not have been able to save that baby. Mm-hmm. But they didn't even try, yeah. right? They didn't even try.
And how will they learn to if they're not trying in these circumstances, right? Like talk about research, talk about effort. This is an opportunity for effort, right? This is an opportunity to work. Well, what did we do in this case to help this baby live as long as possible? And what can we do next time? Whether it's the fact that their lungs weren't developed enough yet, right? Like these are opportunities we have to do the best we can. And I think the medical field has made a plea to help preserve, right, and heal. And that's something that I don't see is the attitude as often anymore.
Well, we have to acknowledge the political dimension, right? We have these strong forces that are anti-life, that are so strongly in favor of abortion. And Congress has said, you can't abort, you know, you have to allow abortion in your state of babies that are not viable outside of the womb. So if we learn, and if we fight for these 22-week-old babies and we establish that this is viable consistently, and then we move on 21-week and 20-week, and we start realizing, oh my gosh, children are viable at earlier and earlier, well, what that does is then it allows states that, like, I hate abortion to say, well, we're not going to let this happen after this point, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you say 22 weeks is viable, abortion in Texas maybe gets pushed back to, you know, before that. And so the forces aligned with death are pushing against this effort to save young children.
One of the good reasons to cover these topics is that you guys, we want you to be equipped to do two things. One, have these conversations with friends and family members. Why is it that on one side of a hospital, they're aborting children at 22 weeks, while on the other side of the hospital, they're fighting to save premature babies at 22 weeks? Do we see the inconsistency here? Pointing these things out and having conversations, helping people to think through and work through this, and then implement laws in their own area, right? To bring attention to viability, to bring attention to the heartbeat. Well, I want to take a little shift here, Chris. I want to talk a little bit about marrying young and how this man, Ben, ends up talking about how he married at 21 and it really changed how he was able to interact and work environment and much more.
I love it. I'm an advocate of marrying young. I did not marry young. I would have loved to be married. I married 27. So I guess by the standards of modern, like our modern era, right? That is a little bit young. My wife was 25. I was 27. So by our current standards, we were on the young side. But honestly, we've said this all the time. Like, I wish I met you earlier, right? I would have loved to have met my wife earlier. And so why does that, you know, the idea that marrying young is going to make you a better man, why does that make sense? Well, because men respond to responsibility, right? Mm-hmm. You give a man something to fight for, and he rises to it. And that's the problem, I think, with so many adolescents today. They don't have jobs. They don't feel like they're contributing. They don't feel like they have responsibilities. And they rise to what's expected of them, right? Well, men, that's the way we are. We need a challenge. We need something to fight for. We need someone to defend and stand up for, to you know, provide for.
And I think that there's something beautiful about that. Willing to say there's a desire to provide for someone. There's a desire to care for someone. There's a desire to take on that responsibility. Feminist ideology today tells you that that's bad. That's wrong if you desire that. That's wrong if you want to do that as a man because you want to be controlling. You guys, we've got to press out all of these voices. We have to push them away and recognize that this is a fundamental part of our human nature, right? Fundamental part of growing up and taking on responsibility. And I love this article by Ben Grizzle where he talks on Verily magazine from a man's perspective. You know, I see my single friends, he says, and I see they're lonely, they're unrooted, they have no direction, they lack commitment, they lack taking risks. And he truly points to the fact that that's a difference between being married and not married.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll say just outright, the self-injury that I did to myself before I was married by being in relationships I shouldn't be in, right? By giving my heart away where places it shouldn't have been given to, by doing the dumb, oh, I'm a single guy thing, right? I would have loved to have been married and not have those wounds. And God comes in and brings healing, but I would have loved to not have them, you know? And I think we cheat young people out of the healthy life that they deserve when we go tell them, no, go form all these really terrible habits. You know, go out and do stupid things. Like college should be just about you having that experience and living
your
life.
Get it out of your system.
Get it, but it doesn't get out of your system, you know? And I love that one of my favorite quotes, and I think I heard it in high school, was the chains of habit are too light to be felt until they're too heavy to be broken, right? And how
Repeat
often
that again.
The chains of habit are too light to be felt until they're too heavy to be broken. And how many young men are just forming these terrible habits, you know, whether that be, you know, the promiscuity, you know, or just the habit of walking into a room and assessing it, right? Like looking at the target rich environment kind of mindset, right? Or online pornography or whatever it is, when their heart really desires love, their heart really desires connection, but they've been taught and trained, oh, no, you don't want that. But they do. And you talk to guys who are just lonely. They just want someone to give their heart to. They want someone to give their life to.
And I think that that's a beautiful thing. I mean, you have to be careful. And I've seen this sometimes where some men really want to be married. They almost objectify them, right? To the point of the wife hunt.
Sure.
That's problematic, right? You've got to get to know the person. You can't just say like marriage right away. You might scare the person off, right?
Sure.
You should always have it very clearly that marriage is something that I'm dating toward. And if that's not something that you're dating toward, then there's no reason for us to be dating right now. There was actually, you know, really interesting. This past week, I was looking at something on Prager University, and they were doing a video out on the streets, and they were talking about different views about marriage and male-female roles. And one of the questions bounced at this couple, and the girl says, oh, yeah, I have no plan of being married. I have no plan to get married. And her boyfriend standing next to her, his face drops.
Yeah.
And you just look at it like, do we know whether or not the person we're dating actually wants to get married and when?
Right. And then why are you dating them if they're not planning on it? Why are you just building up all of that attachment to just have it be severed?
Married men tend to live a decade longer. They're happier, more confident. They relate better to other people in the work environment. They're grounded in themselves, and they have more sex too than single men. It's just a fact of the matter if you look at the research. So we just want to challenge people, consider marriage, consider taking on the responsibility, and take that leap moving forward.
This has been Trending with Chris and Timmery. To learn more about Chris Mueller or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak at your upcoming event, visit everydaycatholic.com or timmery.com.